Coming up on Broadway Radios this week on Broadway, we talk with Douglas Sills. After that, we talk about my favorite year at the York Theatre Company with the musicals in Mufti, Peter Pan Live on NBC, and we talk about the Wall Street Journal columnist Joanne Kaufman's Confession of a Broadway Bolter. Please stay tuned.
Into darkness, into danger, into storms that rip the night. Don't give in, don't give up, but give thanks for the glorious fight. You can tremble, you can fear it, but keep your fighting spirit alive, boys. Let the shiver and sting you fling into battle spring to your feet, boys. Never hold back your step for a moment. Never doubt that your courage will grow. Hold your head even higher and into the fire we go.
Hello and welcome to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway for the week of December 8th, 2014. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast this evening, we have Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier. Peter is a theater journalist and historian with a number of books, his most recent being Strippers, Showgirls, and Sharks. His columns appear at MTI, Critchland, Masterworks, Broadway, and many other places. Good evening, Peter.
Good evening, indeed.
Hello. Also with us is Michael Portantier. Michael is a theater reviewer and essayist whose work appears at Talk in Broadway, The Sondheim Review, and Broadway Stars. He is also a photographer whose work can be seen at followspotphoto.com as well as many of the places on the internet. Good evening, Michael.
Good evening.
With us this evening, we have a very special guest. Douglas Sills is joining us. Broadway fans remember Douglas from The Scarlet Pimpernel and Little Shop of Horrors. And closing a couple of days ago was the York Theatre Company's week-long production of My Favorite Year. So, Douglas, welcome to Broadway Radio.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be on.
So tell us about My Favorite Year. You know, what's your experience been? What was your experience with the show before you got cast in the York production?
None, almost, other than the movie. And that was a long time ago. I'm certainly a huge fan of the composer-writers, and although I don't know Joe Doherty, and Joe wasn't around for this particular go-round, he wrote the book. So I had a fairly cursory knowledge of the movie, the plot and the characters, and found it to be pretty delicious, and am a big fan of Stephen and Lynn's and their music. So the chance to do it in New York, not have to go anywhere, is that was a great thing. They're important in our industry, and they've certainly been important in my development and me falling in love with the theater. So it was a great opportunity, and that was sort of the knowledge I went in with. I'd not worked with the director, who was Dan Konecdis, and I'd not worked with the theater before, I don't think, New York. And I knew some of the other actors, although I don't think I had worked with them. It just turned into this great thing. While the rehearsal was extremely abridged,
yeah,
crazy, we seemed to be doing more and more with less and less time. I think we did this in 4 days. Unexpectedly was so pleased with the result. I mean, I'd hope to have a great time and have a great result, but given how chaotic some of the rehearsal process was, for no other reason than we just have such little time and there's no money, I just was so wonderfully surprised by the result and had such a great time with the other performers.
It's a great show. Do you know if they had made any changes or updates since the Lincoln Center production?
Oh, quite a few. Yeah.
They made quite a few. Yeah. I think they tightened it, and there was new music. I think Stephen at one point, the figure he mentioned was four new songs. And I couldn't say if they were written recently or if they had been cut from the prior show. So I know I had at least one. I know they tightened the book, and the setting was obviously much different. I didn't see the first go-round, but I know the size theater it was in, and I'm told that the size theater and the shape of the stage were pretty significant in a loss of intimacy with the comedy.
Yes,
so it's, at the it's York Theater, it's pretty small, and people could really get a sense of it.
We had mentioned it recently in terms of the space at the Vivian Beaumont, which is where the original production was, in terms of the staging of the show being so much larger. But then Lynn Ahrens made the point at the talkback after your performance on Saturday afternoon, which was so really such a smart, good point, that in a place like that, the laughter tends to disperse more than in a smaller proscenium stage, and I think she's right that had something to do with it not being the ideal space for a show like this, which has such really such wonderful comedy in it.
Yeah, I think the depth and breadth of the stage too makes comedy more challenging because you can't make a quick exit.
Sure,
it's important to be able to say a line and go within two steps or three steps. And slam a door behind yourself for effect and rhythm, just the rhythm of it. There's music to it. And obviously on a big stage like that, you can't do things quickly. So it turned out wonderfully and people seemed extremely excited about it. And that made me very happy to be able to provide that. I think all actors want to be able to do.
I think that many other people obviously felt the same you did. This is something that they really wanted to be involved with, because I can quite safely say you will never see a better cast for My Favorite Year. I mean, you had Adam Chandler Barrett, Rose Hemingway, Frances Jew, Richard Kind, Leslie Kritzer, Daniel Marcus, Christine Petty.
Fantastic. It was pretty fantastic. And the support staff, David Holzenberg at the piano,
yep,
doing music. And just for me, to get to work with Richard, we've known each other and admired each other for a long time, and we have a very unique kinship, I think. And to have Adam in there, it was a great trio. That particularly, I had known Richard before, and I'd known who Adam was and seen his work, but not worked with him. And it was a great chemistry. I knew Christine before, but not worked with her. I knew Rose a little bit, but not worked with her. So it was a great chance to get to know these people, and you forge these very intense intimacies in such a short period of time that they tend to echo for a long time after that when you see each other on the street. Obviously, your social circles don't tend to change after doing something for a week. And if you didn't see a person regularly before, likely you won't see them regularly again. But when you do run into them accidentally, there's this great fondness, like, you were in the trenches together in World War I or something. So that's
much different than the encores, where it's a much bigger
canvas
production, more people involved and things like that, and
yeah,
you break down into separate casts to record, not to record but to rehearse.
Yeah, and they're very organized, and they have obviously a much deeper pocket at Encores, and I've done two or three things for them, and they've actually contacted me about something coming up. And so I've enjoyed those as well. It's a little less informal. You know everybody in the world's going to be there in this glorious big stage, and that it will be reviewed by the New York Times, and all that stress can change the chemistry quite a bit.
Have you been back to Encores after they did the construction?
No, I've not, actually. No, not yet. I assume you've been there.
Yeah, so
it's really much improved. It's quite a wonderful thing,
and also they've built in recording facilities they upgraded the recording facilities to be able to record the shows there as well. So that's always nice. So
that's great.
Yeah, coming up, you have Mr. Magoo's Christmas Carol this Monday coming up. Tell me about that. What is it?
The Actors Fund often does one-night benefits, and I did one for them gosh, I guess it was 7 years ago, of On the 20th Century with Maren Mazzie.
Yeah.
And it turned out great. It was
it did.
Just a very magical night. They approached me again, and I was free, and I was trying out a little business strategy of just saying yes for a while, because they tend to, you know, want to read it and know what are we doing and what's the thought behind it and why are we doing, you know. And so this time I just started to say yes for a while. So I said yes. They had asked the same director who did On the 20th Century, wonderful Peter Flynn. And this is a animated television Christmas Carol starring Mr. Magoo from the 70s, I believe. Mm-hmm.
60s, early 60s.
Oh, really?
60s.
Was it 60s?
Okay. Yeah, like 62, I think.
And these wonderful composers, Stein and Merrill, were waiting for another important show. Yeah, to get its green light. And they were doing this. So I don't remember sitting down watching it. It wasn't sort of a family thing. Growing up in a Jewish house, we didn't really watch Christmas Carol all that much. But I, for some reason, when I started to hear the music, it was lodged deep in my psyche, like, you know, like a strawberry seed in your teeth. There was, it was deep somewhere in there because I knew the tunes a little bit. And everyone, my understanding is DreamWorks approached the Actors Fund. DreamWorks owns the rights. And they said, would you do this for us or like to do this? And they said, yes. So it's never been on stage before. And much of the music was cut for time because the time requirement in television is obviously extremely specific. So when they said yes, John McDaniel is putting the music together and orchestrating it, and he'll be conducting a 28-piece, huge, beautiful orchestra on stage. And a lot of the music has been returned, and there'll be music that you haven't heard before, even if you do know it. And I said, but why are you coming to me? I mean, as versatile a person as I hope I am, Magoo is not the first thing I think of when you mention me. You know, I'm like, I can think of 25. Well, and I said, you know, I think we should really talk this through. Normally I would say yes. And so Peter and I talked about it. And it was a consensus. By the way, this adaptation was written by Kim Pinkney, who is a part of the staff at the Actors Fund. And mm-hmm. Tim's a playwright as well. And they just exclaimed how they were looking for an actor. And they thought it wasn't so important that it be Magoo or Magoo-esque. I thought that there was something smart about that. Trying to do some kind of live impression of Magoo would only lead to disappointment, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, I suppose there's one in a million chance if you found the exact right actor. And I mean, I suppose it's possible, but it's still going to be some kind of approximation of an animation. And those just, you know, like I think of that Flintstone movie, you know, with the live action where people wore those costumes. You know, it just
John Goodman, yeah.
So I thought, you know, there's something smart in here. I don't know what the right answer is, but if you guys are game, I guess I'm game. Unfortunately, Peter had to pull out. There was some illness in his family. So a wonderful guy named Carl Andrus stepped in to direct. And Carl's been an associate. He's worked and directed for the Actors Fund a lot, and he's done quite a few projects with Charles Bush. He's very savvy in the canon of musicals, and very organized, and has a lovely sense of humor and loves to laugh. So he was a great person to go to. And my first ever rehearsal was today. And, you know, again, we have 1 week, so they're cramming a ton of stuff in. And while I was doing My Favorite Year last week, they were rehearsing. And they knew that when they asked me. And they said, mm-hmm. Don't worry, we're not worried about it. If you're not, you know, I think we can handle it in a week with you once you're available. So that's sort of how it came to. And they have some great, great people. Jeff Blumenkrantz and Jen Cody and Bob Cuccioli and Josh Henry. I mean, it's a really lovely group of really talented people doing these great cameos. And I'm not exactly sure where this, I guess we could call him a Magoo cousin, is going to land. But I'll figure it out. I think I'll figure it out. And ultimately, what's interesting about this Christmas Carol is it's really, once Magoo gets into the framework of the story, there's no Magoo-ism. He's just playing it as the telling of the story. There's no funny voice. There's no, I can't see. There's no, oh, danger. I'm going to, you know, there's going to be a car accident because I can't see, all that myopic stuff. They just do a straight telling of the story. And I think therein lies sort of our entry point, because the story obviously is incredibly strong and touchy. And this score has not been heard really live, certainly. And it's unique and beautiful. And I can't tell you the number of people who've come to me and said, that is my favorite Christmas Carol. That is my favorite. And I'm like, you've got to be kidding me. Really? I mean, you know, so many people come to me and that's the best. And I'm like, okay, all righty then. So we had a great first day, and they're so on it there. They have it together. And I'm looking forward to it. It should be fun. You know, everyone really gets pumped and focused, and they understand you're only going to get one shot. And you sort of have the best in the business putting their talents on the line. And oftentimes there's just an extraordinary result, kind of like that on the 20th Century, like My Favorite Year. The only thing missing is a lot of money to the actor.
Well,
it can be very satisfying.
I had been saying for years that someone should do this on stage in some form. So as soon as it was announced, I immediately bought a ticket. But what a wonderful surprise, because I don't believe you were on the initial casting announcement. They just listed a bunch of people, most of whom you just mentioned. But
right.
they didn't – you were not listed, and nor did they say who was playing whom. So now I uh-huh. see that – let's see Bob Cuccioli is Marley's ghost. Eric Altemus is young Ebenezer Scrooge. Lilias White is the charwoman. Joshua Henry is Bob Cratchit. Jeff Blumenkrantz is, let's see, I guess the other people, I guess, are pretty much multiple roles or ensemble. But it's how
you know,
wonderful.
There's that sequence where the people are in his bedchamber after he's dead, you know, picking through his belongings. And those evil types are Jen Cody and Jeff Blumenkrantz and I'm having a stroke. Who's the third? It's another wonderful person.
John Bolton?
No, John is playing John's playing the director of Magoo's director.
Magoo
is sort of this wonderful stage actor in this thing. He's coming back to Broadway to play Scrooge, and John plays his director. He's he's great. I can't believe I can't remember who the third
Chris
wonderful.
Sieber? Chris Sieber?
Yes, I think it must be Chris. I think that's right.
And Beth Wolf is in it?
It's Clea Blackhurst.
Oh, Clea Blackhurst.
Clea. And I think John is playing, I can't remember which character John's playing. Anyway, yeah, Chris Sieber's in it. It's a great group. I've been very fortunate, you know, right before I did this. I think I'm assuming there's nothing unique about what's going on in my career and life, that everyone is doing a ton of readings and workshops. You know, that's how the process is evolving.
Yeah, we were talking
that's
about how Broadway is sort of having its a sort of pilot season on the East Coast for Broadway.
Right.
You know, and this is how it's manifests itself.
You know, the interesting thing, the economic model for actors is a unique one, because we want to do it, and the essential element is we will do it for nothing. So where there are business concerns, for example, the musicians union or the Teamsters, when a group of Teamsters comes together and they decide, you know, we're not going to work if this is the scenario, they don't work. They all stand behind. With actors, you can't really get the entire community of actors to hold a strike line. So, because it's something we love and we'll do it. If 20,000 people decide they won't do a certain thing as an actor, there's going to be another 20,000 that will. So you can't hold a strike line. It's very difficult to have collective bargaining. And essentially what happens is, as pressures increase, that element of the geometry of producing a play that is that is more flexible. That is, the actor gets pushed. So what happens is, you know, they have these 29-hour readings, and, you know, you cram a whole bunch of stuff in a week. And there's a lot of that sort of hybrid kind of a thing going on between the Actors Fund and encores and reprises and these one-night benefits. And, you know, obviously everyone wants to see the vehicle go to the next step, so they want to give it its best reading. And, they, you know, for example, what's interesting is the Actors Union, in an effort to watch out for the actors, has decided to help the actor by saying the actors have to carry books. You can't ask them to learn this, in an effort to denote the difference between a fully rehearsed piece and a piece that's not fully rehearsed. And the actors complain, like, I want to get rid of my book. I want to act. I want these books. And the producer says, no, your union has said we can't ask you to put your book down. And it's just comical that, you know, the union, who is us, the actors, are trying to be protective and see that you're not forced to try and cram a one-month rehearsal into a four-day process. And nor should the audience ever be in the impression that this is a full and finished product in an effort to protect the actors, you know. But the actors want to put the book down. they want to sing without looking. And it's just a funny thing, the way that works. So everybody's doing them.
I don't know if you know this, Doug, but that has apparently been renegotiated at Encores. I think because the rehearsal period has been lengthened somewhat.
Right. I think they're allowed to have you not have the book for a number or two. Is that the way it works or something?
Well, I'm not sure. You have seen very few books, if any, in recent Encores.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because I think they just renegotiated it. And as I say, I think they may have added some, you know, like, I don't know how many days you have to add to the rehearsal period. But I think that's what happened. But
it's wonderful and it's unfortunate. You know, it's both things.
Yeah.
You get this, it's when you see something come over like Matilda or War Horse, something that was really worked in a studio that was developed over time, where a group of people came to understand each other, know what to expect and have a deeper connection. The response of the audience is no different from going to a fine restaurant versus fast food. And I just worry that we're feeding ourselves a less high quality diet of theater by throwing things together so quickly, and not having a national theater or some kind of incubation device to have more rehearsal, because more rehearsal oftentimes will lead to more interesting things with more depth and subtlety. I know that our nonprofits like Lincoln Center are supposed to help do that for us, but we know that sometimes they do and sometimes they can't.
Well, that's a very good point. But I suppose benefits are sort of in a separate class. And I will say, I'm so happy that I got to see you as Oscar Jaffe in On the 20th Century. That was so much fun. Fantastic. And, because not everyone can do a full Broadway production of every show. The one I'm really still waiting for, Douglas, is have you ever done Kiss Me, Kate?
No. At the last revival, they had asked if I wanted to do it after Brian had opened.
Right.
Or if I wanted to go to London or on the road. And we never sort of came to terms, or they didn't have time to re-rehearse. And I said, listen, you know, Brian's done a fantastic job and I don't think I would fit into his choices. So if we don't have time to rehearse, maybe that's not the best. So we didn't do it. In London, when they offered it, the pay when someone goes to London with the taxation, if they're paying in dollars, it's very minimal. You often will lose money. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry that I haven't done it. No, I would love to do it at some point. I think I would have a ton of fun doing it. I had an interesting project with Alice Ripley 2 weeks ago. We did a musicalization of The Shining.
Really?
It was a spoof of The Shining, and it was really funny. So good stuff comes out of these things, these workshops and things. And hopefully somebody will pick it up. But, I've been fortunate enough to get asked quite a bit. And for me, if I don't have to audition, I'm very happy. I don't know too many people that enjoy auditioning, so I've been really fortunate. And there's some other things coming up in the same kind of, in the same vein. Somebody's doing a new Faustus, and there's, as I mentioned, there's a new project that encores that they have called me about, a Gershwin piece, and so we'll see.
Do you mean Lady Be Good or something else?
Right, yeah, to be a part of that project. So, and I live in New York full-time now, and I know I've traveled quite a bit in my career, both doing tours, and I've had a home on the West Coast as well. But I'm here full-time, so I'm hoping that there'll be some other wonderful things down the pike. And people keep saying, are you ever going to do something at 54 Below? And so I've started to think about it, but it's never been something that I've been drawn to, that kind of solo presentation. I'm a creature of rehearsal, and I think the thing that draws me to performing is the synergy between people. And, you know, you don't get that, obviously, in a cabaret setting as much, certainly between the musicians. But
tell us about... You did a show with Renee Fleming at the Williamstown Theater Festival. Was it Living on Love?
Right, exactly. So Kathleen Marshall called me. I had done a workshop, Finding Neverland, for 4 weeks. And I wasn't going to go forward with the production, and so I became available for the summer. And Kathleen called me and said, listen, I have this great play. Joe DiPietro, who wrote... I Love You, Perfect Not Change, and a thousand other things, including Nice Memphis. Work If You Get It, and Memphis, has written this complete rewrite adaptation of this play called Peccadillo by Garson Kanin, which never came into New York. And they were doing it at Williamstown, and I said, yes, I did read it. Yeah, I did read it. It was with Kathleen and Renee Fleming. And Renee has never done a play. She's never spoken dialogue on stage.
And her character is an opera singer, correct?
Right. In this piece, as it's been rewritten, this husband and wife team in the 50s, she's a diva who is probably at the peak or just past the peak of her career. And her husband is a very emotional Italian conductor who's also paranoid about being past his peak. They have no children. What they do have is opposite sex biographers, younger opposite sex biographers in the house writing their biographies. And sex and hilarity ensue. And... it was pretty great. Justin Long and Anna Klumsky. Justin does 1,000 movies, literally. He's hysterical. Most people might know him from the Apple commercials with PC, with John Hodgman, Apple Mac, Apple PC commercials. And Anna Klumsky from Veep was the other biographer. And they just ate it up with a spoon. It was incredibly successful. Again, another situation where you're, you know, rehearsing very quickly. And we had a lot of fun. And they're saying that they have the Broadway money and they want it to come in this spring. And like a lot of shows, I think we're supposedly waiting for a theater, the right theater. Obviously, there are certain theaters that are too big for a play. Renee didn't sing. She ended up singing a little bit casually, but nothing formal, no song per se, but she hums and kind of, you know, the way an artist might doodle on a pad, she's sort of singing in the show, but no real singing. And she was game and she was great. And I think she was really hooked on the laughter. I mean, she's had a mega career, but they don't really laugh like that at opera. I mean, this was waves and waves of laughter. And I could see her becoming addicted. I could just, it's like watching somebody shoot heroin, you know. I mean, I could just see. I said, oh, my gosh, she's never going to be the same after this. And she had a great time. And to her credit, you know, to do something like this, which is very, it's a tough thing. It's the lead in a comedy, a new comedy. So you're going to be doing rewrites and, you know, telling jokes, and you're with other very experienced people in that field. In a very short period of time, I thought she was wonderfully game, and she did a great job. People loved seeing her. I wouldn't say she made fun of herself, but there was a bit of meta, if you will, an awareness of who she is and where she is in her career. And the element of being out of her element by being in a play. And I think people rooted for her vulnerability in that regard. So, and I think also, frankly, the play would hold up with another wonderful actress, that she doesn't have to be a singing star.
We'll see.
It would be fun to do, and I got to study a different dialect, and that was fun. And Williamstown is just an extraordinary, you know, it's beautiful, and there's really talented people, and there's some really famous people, and there's just scoops full of young interns, you know, soaking it up, and places to pass on your knowledge, and it's just great. I was really lucky and happy to do it.
Mike, what were you going to say?
Well, she's about to do The Merry Widow at the Met with Kelly O'Hara in her
right
in her
and debut. Nathan Gunn.
Kelly,
yeah, I was just texting with her. I'm going to get some tickets to go see her do that.
And I have to say, roughly 25 years ago, I'll never forget this. I was at the Met to see The Marriage of Figaro, and I'm not 100% sure who there was a fairly major star who was supposed to be the Countess, and they about 10 minutes before they made an announcement that, you know, so and so is indisposed, and in her place the role of the Countess will be sung in her Metropolitan Opera debut by Renee Fleming.
Oh my gosh!
Of course, nobody knew who never heard of her. It was her debut, but they sure heard of her after that, and wasn't it my dumb luck to be there for that?
You know, it was so fascinating. This is a person whose career is, you know, like Michael Jordan. I mean, she's a legend. She's an international legend. In fact, maybe more celebrated out of our country than in our country because of the passion for classical music and opera in other countries. But she suffers the injuries of performing just as everyone does. She's tenderhearted to criticism and to failed projects or projects that didn't go as well as she'd hoped. And, you know, I think we have a tendency to think that it might be otherwise at a certain point of achievement, and it isn't. And she's everyone knows she's extremely down to earth and very regular folk. We shared many an ice cream cone, and she's just a regular lady, with an incredible international career.
She sure nailed the Star Spangled Banner. Was that last year?
Right, that was great. Yeah,
that became world famous.
You'd think nobody had ever heard the Star Spangled Banner before. By the way, everyone reacted. It was so funny. It was great.
If we can get them to rewrite "Lend Me a Tenor" to "Lend Me a Soprano" and and have her bring it to Broadway, do you think you could talk her into that, Douglas?
Yeah, because I have so much influence. Yeah, sure. Yeah, absolutely. She refuses to tell a joke now without talking to me first. Yeah, absolutely. No.
You're her dealer now. You give her a little Broadway. Hey, Renee, I'll give you a little Broadway if you come over here.
That's right. She's addicted to the laughs now. Right? I wonder how she's doing without it. But it was funny because we'd rehearse and we'd do something intense, and she'd say to me, "Look, I looked you up. I know you sing. I mean, you sing beautifully, and you're shouting on stage. I don't understand. How do you shout on stage and use your voice that way and then sing?" She was so careful about her speech on stage, how she spoke, because that instrument is so delicate and you just can't create that friction or the inflammation that comes with misusing your voice. And she had a concert to do at Tanglewood while we were rehearsing. So I'm just an incredible admirer of her. She did great. I don't think she understood quite. Every day we would get new pages, and she's used to doing things written by dead guys.
Repertoire. Yeah.
nobody's writing new scenes for Figaro, and certainly not every day getting rewrites. And she wanted to arrive memorized because that's how they do it. You know, they arrive at rehearsal. Well, you know, she quickly realized that that wasn't going to be helpful. And she came to that, you know, how do I learn all these lines? How am I going to? But she did fine. I don't think, you know, they get so little rehearsal. I don't think she realized how much rehearsal we were going to have. Although ultimately, as is the case with new plays, not near as much as we would have hoped. And you go on the first time with A Wing and a Prayer. You know, we've been talking on this interview about the time constraint in these new sort of abridged rehearsal processes. And it strikes me that there's so much adrenaline and cortisol flowing through your body that I'm the addict. I keep saying yes, and I keep doing these things, even though my body is flooded with this intense stress hormone right before you go on. I mean, it's crazy what we do. Just crazy, crazy, crazy.
Talk about crazy a little bit. Tell us about the 5,000 Fingers of Dr. T.
So this is a wonderful piece, a musical piece. It's an adaptation of a live action, the only live action Dr. Seuss movie. Again, I'm going to be rough on the dates. I don't know if it's 50s or 60s. I've not watched it on purpose.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a live-action movie called The 5,000 Fingers of Dr. T, written by Dr. Seuss, Ted Geisel. And this wonderful composer, conductor, musician, entrepreneur named Glenn Rovin. And if you Google Rovin, you would see how wide and intense his the breadth of his career has been, and a wonderful comedic writer named Maria Schlatter, whose father is George Schlatter of Laugh-In fame and many other television shows, have written this wonderful piece, and I would play this maniacal piano teacher who falls into a dream sequence. His student, he is a young student, who falls into a dream sequence where Dr. T, his name is Dr. Terwilliger, becomes the ruler of the world and imprisons these children and forces them to learn his method of piano. Mm. And it's a wonderful sort of satire about fascism, and I think it was post-war sensations. And it's really funny, and they've written these great, great scores, just our songs. They're so much fun to do, and I'm hoping that their producer will prevail and will be able to do it at some point.
I have not seen the never seen the movie, but it has quite a famous reputation as a kind of a cult film. It's really, from what I've seen of it, it's really over the top. And it's 1953, by the way.
53, yeah.
And I believe Mr. Dr. Terwilliger was played by Hans Conried.
I don't know how I always get saddled with these over-the-top guys, but I'm content to do it. It's perfectly lovely. I mean, I think it would lend itself to the theater beautifully, and the imaginative director and set decorator, where you're living inside a piano, his breakfast garden is... the inside of a piano. And, you know, it just lends itself to these glorious, glorious scenes. And I just think it would be, you know, and it's a great kids piece and adults can see it on a different level. I saw
a little clip of it, and it sort of reminds me of a cross between A Clockwork Orange and Willy Wonka.
Right. I think that's an apt description. And we've had some great people. I've done it with Tom McGowan. I've done it with, I think I did that with Alice Ripley once. I've done it with Rachel York. I've done it with a lot of wonderful actresses. I've done it a few times for Backers. So that's another project that's been floating out there.
Well, I'm glad that you are. I did not know until recently that you're back on the East Coast full time. So we hope to be seeing much, much more of you.
I'm afraid right now the people that have seen the most of me are the people at the front desks at the major studios where we rehearse all these readings and workshops.
Oh, hi, Sills. How you doing? Yeah, you're in 6N. You're down the hall, and there's no potato chips in the machine, so forget that. You know, it's like, okay,
and the elevator's broken.
Right. But, you know, you get to see everybody in these places, which is kind of fun, and you do get to keep a pulse on other shows that are going on. You know, whenever you go into these studios, you see who else is rehearsing and or auditioning, and that's always fun, too. Today I was in the elevator with my friend David Hyde Pierce.
Yeah.
And David and I had a wonderful reading a week ago, Monday, at Lincoln Center. John Guare has rewritten a play he wrote, Where Are You, McPhee, with Jerry's act. There was a long period of time for
really?
Them. They had a great partnership, and then they didn't have much to do with one another. And recently they had a coming back together, and they worked on this piece, and I was lucky enough to be asked to come in to Lincoln Center and read it for the day with David Hyde Pierce. And it was extraordinary, really. It was like it had a lot of flavor of House of Blue Leaves, but a much more mature writer, and it reflected, I think, the zeitgeist of today. And it was imaginative, and it had surreal elements. There was sort of magical realism to it, and David Hyde Pierce was a great spine for it. It was, you know, just one of those things you dream about as a young actor in graduate school, to work on a new John Guare play with Jerry Zaks and David Hyde Pierce at Lincoln Center. You know,
yeah.
I was like, okay, I can die. I'm ready. I've lived my dream.
Well, Douglas, thank you so much for spending so much time with us this evening. We really appreciate it. And I'm very excited to hear about all these projects. And Michael, I'm sure, will come back and give us a full report on Mr. Magoo's Christmas Carol next week.
So well, you guys are great to do this and keep the blood flowing through the body of the body politic of musicals and theater in general. And your contributions are known to us, and so I'm honored to be asked, and it's been fun to do it. So thank you guys for all you do.
Great, and we'll have you back after you can tell us when 5,000 Fingers comes to Broadway.
Yeah!
All righty. Thank you so much, and have a wonderful evening.
Thanks, guys. You too.
Bye-bye.
Thanks, Douglas.
All right. Due to the miracle of technology, Peter has joined us. So Peter, welcome into the conversation. We're sorry that you missed the conversation with Douglas Sills, but let's talk about My Favorite Year. Peter and Michael got a chance to see it, so why don't we get a review? Peter, why don't you just give us a start on that?
I liked it quite a bit. One thing that I think should be mentioned is the fact that they've improved the movie. The movie had a very strange and silly subplot involving gangsters. It seemed that King Kaiser, who had this phenomenally successful TV show based actually on your show of shows with Sid Caesar, he was doing a sketch about gamblers and hitmen, that type of thing. And these people whom he was parodying were not amused and were threatening him. So what happened at the end of the show is the gangsters try to sabotage the show, and it breaks into a big fight scene, which the audience takes as legitimate. They think they're actually seeing a sketch where everybody is beating everybody up, and they're laughing uproariously. Now, all this, of course, impacts Alan Swan, too, who is the star of the show this week, the guest star, who's a big Errol Flynn-type guy, appearing in movies like Adventures of Robin Hood, those type of daring do pictures. And Alan is now more famous for being a drunk and hasn't worked terribly much anymore. But everybody's hoping that he's going to straighten out and get it all together. Fine. Well, at the end of the movie, the issue is the fact that it's a live TV show and he gets cold feet because he's used to retakes. He does come through in the movie because what he does is grab a cable and he starts breaking up the fight that we see with the gangsters. But here it's more emotional because the movie does touch upon the fact that he has a daughter he hasn't seen very much. And as a result, they're estranged. And here there's much more of an effort about the daughter. And what gets him to perform live is the fact that he finds out the daughter is in the audience and he doesn't want to let her down. I think that's stronger emotionally. I think it's good getting rid of the gangsters. So I think the book is very much improved there. I think the show really suffered terribly at Lincoln Center 21 years ago because it was on a thrust stage. This is an old-fashioned musical. That's a compliment. And it it needs a proscenium age. You know, you got to have the right frame for a picture, and this one needs a conventional frame. And so it played very, very well at the York. But more to the point, one of the reasons it played so well is because the cast was phenomenal. It was certainly a Broadway-level cast. I mean, having Christine Petty playing the Lenny Kazan role, certainly having Andrea Chandler Barat playing the role that Mark Lynn Baker played in the movie, and Evan Pappas played on stage. Douglas Sills, good Lord. I mean, you know, that's Tim Curry, who we know from Rocky Horror Show, Rocky Horror Picture Show, to be precise, certainly was game and had a lot of quality. But Douglas Sills really has that derring do in his soul, you know, and so so he was quite wonderful, too. And Richard Kind as King Kaiser certainly trumped what Tom Martirosian did a long time ago. So really tremendous, tremendous cast. And in supporting roles, Daniel Marcus, who's always wonderful, did a terrific job. Leslie Kritzer tore down the house with professional show business comedy. This is the role that won Andrea Martin a Tony, which was pretty impressive considering the show lasted only a matter of weeks when it was first produced. So it was great that Andrea Martin won a Tony, but I don't recall her getting the type of hand that Leslie Kritzer got after doing professional show business comedy. So a tremendously successful effort. They did rewrite it a bit. I think the rewrites were fine. They seemed to be lateral moves to me. I didn't miss anything. I drove to Boston after the show and I listened to the CD, and I didn't miss much of what was cut. And I didn't think that what was added was vitally, tremendously important or different. But still, it's a show that's a lot of fun. The real problem is when you're watching these writers in the room, if you know the Dick Van Dyke Show, you wish that the dialogue were as good as it was for Buddy and Sally and Rob in the Dick Van Dyke Show. It's too bad that Sam Persky and Bill Denoff, the head writers of the Dick Van Dyke Show, weren't called in to do this musical. It might have turned out to be more fun. If they had, but still, it's a worthwhile show, and I had a terrific time.
I should note Rose Hemingway, who played the love interest, and she at one point has a wonderful duet in Act One called "Funny / The Duck Joke" with Leslie Kritzer. And at one point during the song, the point is that. Leslie's trying to teach Rose how to tell a joke because, you know, she's oh, I'm not funny. But she then tells the joke incredibly badly. And I think it requires a really special talent to tell a joke so badly and still bring down the house, which is exactly what she did. Mm-hmm. So, yes, the cast across the board was just stupendous. And, you know, I didn't even remember that about the gangsters in the movie, Peter. That's how little of an impression that made on me. I guess maybe the movie wasn't as as good as I mean, it had a lot of heart
to it.
It sure did.
Yeah. When it did right, it did very right. I also want to say that if you've never been to a Mufti, you must go. Really, it's worth a trip to New York. I mean, plan your trip to see all the big hits, all the Tony winners, along with when there's a Mufti, because the audience is so smart. These are the people who really care about musicals, live for them, and being with such an educated crowd who knows what to look for and what to care about is a very special thing. You really feel at home. If you really care about the Broadway musical and you're the type of person who collects the albums, et cetera, you belong in the Mufti audience, and you'll have a wonderful time meeting people who understand you, and you'll understand them too.
Mm-hmm. All right. So very, very exciting, especially on the heels of that conversation we just had with Douglas about how you know, putting these shows up is done on a wing and a prayer.
Yeah.
And
okay.
And it's great to see a positive outcome coming out of this.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so let's move forward into the other big event of the week, which was NBC's live production of Peter Pan. So, Peter, Michael, let's get your take on it. I want to start off with it, Michael.
Oh, gee, do I have to?
You should do.
Well, it's hard to discuss. It's hard to talk about it for me. I just was hoping that it was going to be so much better than last year. And in some ways, I think it was worse. Although the first 10 minutes, I tell you, it was heartbreaking to me, because the first 10 minutes or so I thought were fantastic, because the first 10 minutes involved Kelly O'Hara, Christian Borle, Taylor Lauterman, both of the other kids who played the darling children. Mm-hmm. And they were all fantastic. But then I just don't know if Allison Williams' performance was pitched at that level because of her own doing entirely, or because the director told her to do that, or didn't know even enough to tell her not to do that. I was half joking to people that it was almost as if someone did not tell Allison Williams or Christopher Walken that it was the live telecast, and that they thought it was still a rehearsal and they were marking through. I've never seen anything like that, and I can't quite believe it. And, you know, and then there's all these negative comments, and then people get very upset about the negative comments and call people haters, and we should be supportive. Some fellow who wrote a blog wrote a whole thing where he tried to bring it, boil it down to math, you know, explaining how many people saw this one telecast, and how long it would take, you know, how many Broadway performances it would take the same amount of people to see any one thing like that. But and saying that it should be supported for that reason, and all talking about all the children who see it. But I'm not sure I agree, because if what they're seeing is not good, I think it could have the opposite effect. And I don't know a lot of children that age personally, so I can't poll them as to what they felt. A lot of people seem to feel that younger people enjoyed it much more. I would think they would almost enjoy it less because of the lack of energy. Kid who's become famous, that adorable young man who's become famous for reviewing shows on video, that Ian, do you know who I'm talking about?
Yeah.
He seemed to love it, so I assume he's telling the truth. But I just don't know. I mean, if they did see it and they did like it, then that is a positive. But I just can't help thinking how much better it could have been done with different cast and different director, different cast for the two leads, I should say, and a different director. I did not like the fact that the Lost Boys were grown men. I thought the pacing was off, not the pacing when people were saying the lines, but sort of the space between the lines. That show should not be 3 hours, even with all those commercials. I'm sorry. And even with all the additions, which were completely unnecessary, I felt. So another huge missed opportunity. And I hate to be a pessimist, but I've given up any hope of thinking that it'll be better in the future, unless they completely change the creative team.
So, Peter, what did you think?
I'm going to be very controversial here, and this I may lose a million listeners for what I have to say about this Peter Pan. I do think that if you're a senior citizen, you didn't like it at all, because you probably saw Mary Martin way back in 1955. And what we have to remember is we were children then, and we were taken by the novelty of it. And I do think, too, that Mary Martin got by on a pass, because while I'm sure she was great in South Pacific, I didn't see her. I'm sure she was great in The Sound of Music, I didn't see her. she was great in I did see her. But the thing is, you know, you watched that Peter Pan, and I mean, I agree with Mike Clark in USA Today that when the video came out in the 80s, he said this Peter would get so many playground beatings, and that, you know, Mary Martin did not play it masculine. At least Allison Williams seemed masculine, and I think that's significant. And I think what you're talking about, Michael, and I agree with you, that I think that there was certainly an effort here to be far more low-key with this property than we've ever seen before. Was it successful? Probably not. But the idea of Captain Hook not being a camp fest, I think was a conscious decision. Mm. And I don't think it was such a bad one. By the way, the decision, I'm saying, was not a bad one. I'm not saying Christopher Walken gave a good performance. I started thinking, I gave him such a benefit that I'm saying, you know, if you get your hand bitten by a crocodile, you know, you start getting some, you know, world weariness about you. You know, I was really going into that hoping that I could convince myself that that's one of the reasons why he was so low key, that, you know, that he had fought so many battles. He was tired now, you know, but that only lasts so long. But in terms of, you know, this was the most boyish Peter Pan. I wish they had used a boy. I wish they had. I don't see why this has to continue. I know there was a time when it had to continue because the harnesses in those days involved putting it by the crotch area, and a guy just couldn't take it. But the flying by four has improved since then, and you can use a boy, and I think they should have used a boy. But they certainly use somebody more boyish than Mary Martin. And here's where I'm going to get really controversial. And I think one of the reasons that so many of us took to Peter Pan when we were kids, bear with me, and it's fine if you tune me out, but we were the oppressed kids, many of us. I was the last one picked for the ball team. I was the one who used to get playground beatings from Eddie Considine on a daily basis. You know, and as a result, seeing somebody who wasn't that masculine, who was a leader of boys, who could fly, you know, I mean, that was something that was very appealing to me. And I have a feeling I'm not alone on that. And, you know, I mean, the story just doesn't even make sense on a basic level because, yeah, when you think of it, why aren't the other boys flying? Is Peter that stingy with his fairy dust? I mean, you know, why is it? Well, we know why, because hoisting all those kids in the air would cost a fortune. Okay, right. But if they're not flying, and here come these three kids from London who are flying in, you know, I mean, is there going to be some sort of resentment? Yes, I know. I know I'm thinking about it too much, and I know it's a fantasy. But still, I do have a lot of questions as far as that's concerned. I have a feeling, you know, when you think of it, think of the people in this country whose live theater means going to the enormous performing arts center in their town and seeing a non-equity or a bus and truck production. I bet this looked pretty good to them. That's the real bottom line here. It seems that the road has not been killed by these non-equity tours. I'm not endorsing them, mind you, or the bus and trucks that, you know, have woebegone scenery, any of these troika tours that really are really from hunger. You know, and people go and they pay a lot of money for them, I'm sorry to say. And they come out and say, yeah, that was good, you know, because it's the best they've seen. You know, they and I think this applies here. I have a feeling that John Q. Public, or little Johnny Q. Public, I guess I should say, had a good time at this. And so for that reason, I guess it's okay. It's network TV. Think about it. It's for the masses. You know, and under those circumstances, I think it's serving its audience. I think we, who know a good deal about the musical theater and aficionados and compare and contrast, and yeah, I mean, you know, I did a book a few years ago called Broadway MVPs, the most valuable players of the last 50 years. And for the 1979-80 season, which was the Patti LuPone Evita season, my most valuable player was Sandy Duncan and Peter Pan. She was terrific. And not only that, I saw her in February. She opened in August, and I'm telling you, you'd swear it was an opening night performance. It was a Wednesday matinee, and she was so good to those children in that audience. She made them feel special, blah, blah, blah. Well, anyway, you know, so I mean, I'm not impervious to other things involving Peter Pan. I saw really good people do it, no question. But at least I like the attempt at masculinity, and I like the attempt of toning Hook down. So under those circumstances, I didn't hate it. That said, I haven't finished watching it. It's taking me forever. I'm in the third act now, you know. So that's where I am, but I don't think the rest of it's going to change my opinion. I have 25 minutes to go. So.
I don't disagree with a lot of what you said, Peter, but I actually think, first of all, Sandy Duncan gave one of the greatest performances have ever seen in my life.
Bet.
But also, I would say to me, she was more masculine than either Allison Williams or Mary Martin. So that's one of the things I loved about it so much. And I guess you and I, Peter, are, I think we're in the relative minority in saying that we want to see an actual young male do it. If I do think if it was the right person, it could be really really something.
I agree.
It's just,
I mean, when you think about it, there was a movie about 10, 15 years ago, Where a Boy Played Peter Pan. It was not the musical at all.
Jeremy Sumpter.
Yeah, and I mean, it was really great because, I mean, one of the things was he was filthy. I mean, he was, his feet were filthy, and they would be. You know, I mean, Neverland is not a place where the maid comes in and, you know, cleans up every day, you know. So it was very realistic, you know, and I thought that was good. And I think it can use some realism. So, you know, it's a very hard show in many, many ways. And frankly, I don't know if we ever talked about it on this podcast, but when they announced it, I thought it was a mistake because I saw all sorts of traps that it could run into. And I think time has really passed this property by in terms of really scoring with today's audiences. So I think kids might have just been amazed by so many things in it. And, you know, we, as kids, we all would have loved to have known how to fly. So I think that's very appealing as well. We wish we were those two little kids, those two little boys, or if we're a girl, Wendy, you know, to fly in the air and go through and have a wonderful time. Sure, of course. I also think, by the way, it would be very nice if it all took place in a very short period of time and they get back home before the parents got home from their evening out on the town. I think that would have been very nice. The idea of these parents, you know, wondering where their kids are for a long time is something that bothers me a lot. You know, that's very cruel. But anyway, without my help, Peter Pan has certainly endured for more than a century and probably will still. But anyway, so I didn't hate it. Nope.
So I want to say, just to bring up a few points before we move on, is that when a show is in rehearsal and we go from rehearsal into, you know, dress and invited dresses and then first performance in front of an audience, there's a certain amount of energy that is achieved. And I think that some of the comments that have been talked about with Peter Pan is that, gosh, why don't we just put a live audience there to give something to the actors to make it feel more theatrical? And it doesn't have to be in a traditional theater. They could put the audience in a studio audience type of set. Yeah. They don't have to show the audience, but certainly the actors could feed off of that energy, and the people at home could understand where they're what the theatrical experience is like.
Sure.
To be experiencing with in community, which is one of the greatest things about theater versus watching something else at home by yourself, is that, you know, laughing where somebody else is laughing or laughing where somebody else is not laughing and thinking about the different things like that. So I think that as they do the Music Man next year, that a live audience, I really hope that they can figure out a way to incorporate that and invited live audiences, all sorts of ways that they can do this and make this work.
I did not know.
Watch, it'll be canned laughter. You know?
Oh, that'll be terrible.
Speaking of which, I was laboring under a misapprehension. It wasn't until like 2 days ago that I assume people know what they're talking about. I read that the orchestra was pre-recorded.
Oh. Mm.
And, you know, every little thing you do like that, it takes another layer of spontaneity and energy out of it. Mm-hmm. You're absolutely right about the audience.
Oh, yeah.
And James, a pre-recorded orchestra is worse than a live orchestra, even if they're playing in another room, which is worse than the live orchestra playing in the same room. I mean, it all adds up. And another thing I said to someone is, you know, I wonder if maybe part of the problem here wasn't that they were over rehearsed, and maybe that contributed to the lack of energy and spontaneity.
I brought that up to a friend, and I said, you know, maybe I have a feeling Christopher Walken peaked early. And he said, well, it reminds me of a show I saw out of town where I was working on it, and we kept on saying, she'll get there. She's saving it. And then when the first preview came, she's saving it for opening night. She wasn't saving a damn thing. She couldn't do it, you know. And you know, so that was his rebuttal. And of course, we'll never know. But it did occur to me that he may have peaked. You know, there was so much stuff on this show before it happened. Right. You know, the making of, and I mean, you know, as Linda said to me the other day, I can't tell you how many times I saw Allison Williams as a child in that Peter Pan outfit, you know, on this, that, and the other thing. And it's true. That showed up in a lot of TV things. You know, this is her dream come true, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, I think we have to move on, and we'll see if they do the Music Man. My guess is they will. You know, the official explanation was, if Peter Pan does well enough, we will do the Music Man. And while it didn't do nearly as well as The Sound of Music, the point is they did do better than their usual Thursday. So I have a feeling once a year they're going to throw us a musical theater bone.
Well, and yeah, we all say $9 million versus $18 million for Sound of Music.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
We also supposedly have Grease coming up on another network, Fox, right?
Yeah.
So maybe it'll be interesting to see, aside from everything else, if they take a different approach in terms of some of these things we're discussing.
Hmm. Yeah, and don't forget, Grease is a really tough show if you do it the real way, and I bet they're not going to. The adaptation that happened in the Tommy Toon production back in the 90s, I think we're going to see that, because Grease is a tougher show than people think. And don't forget, we have Elf coming up animated on December 16th. The musical Elf that showed up on Broadway in 2010 and 2012 is going to be an animated special with 9 of the songs from the show in it. I don't think they've written new ones. I don't know about that. I can't say for sure, but I know that 9 of the songs that we know from those 2 productions of Elf we had on Broadway are going to be in there. So Jim Parsons is playing Buddy the Elf,
and then
the voice of.
And then one last point as a father of a 6-year-old and 11.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that. Go ahead.
8 p.m. You can't do 8 p.m. for a 3-hour show.
Yeah.
Awful. Can't do 8 p.m. My kids were, you know, 9:30. They're just done. You know, if you're not wrapping up at 9:30, it was very, very tough.
The question, James, is were they on their hands and knees begging you, please send us to bed, Daddy? I mean, that's the real question. You know? How are we going to bed now?
Well, you know how I don't think it can be a reflection of how good or how bad anything is on television. They never want to go to bed.
What a surprise. By the way, Saturday Night Live did a spoof. As I mentioned, I was in Boston. I was at a friend's house, and Saturday Night Live was on the background. And the selection they chose to musicalize, only about 8 bars, was the Vengeance number, the Ambition number from Do Re Mi, the 1960 musical. Mm-hmm. And I turned to a friend of mine who I've known for a long time. We've had many musical theater adventures together. And I said, would you have ever believed we would have been hearing a melody from Do Re Mi on Saturday Night Live, you know, 54 years after the show was produced? I mean, would we have ever believed it? So even Saturday Night Live got into the act and did something.
So it was a very long evening, starting at 8 o'clock, ending at 11 o'clock, and many, many people, I'd imagine, left halfway through the middle of the show.
Yeah, which, someone posted today an hour by hour breakdown of the and yes, it was
A lot of diminishing returns, no question.
So the big question is, will NBC invite those people back next year to see their next show?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because, you know, if you leave halfway through the show, you might not get invited back the following show.
Yes, I know where you're going, James.
So the Wall Street Journal, Joanne Kaufman, who is a culture editor at the Wall Street Journal, wrote an article last week called Confessions of a Broadway Bolter, where it was subtitled The Deck Per Se Was Ever Thought of Leaving a Performance During the Intermission? You're Not Alone. And she wrote about how she basically does not stay for many, many, many shows that she has been invited to and comped by Broadway press reps. And it has stirred up, of course, this is very inside baseball. It's stirred up a lot of upset people in the Broadway community. So I thought that we would throw it out here to Michael and to Peter and to me and to listeners. If you have any stories, please chime in and let us know. Have you ever left a show halfway through it? So, Peter, what do you think? What do you think about this whole topic?
I've walked out of plenty of shows, but those were shows that I wasn't reviewing. to be fair, when I was married, my wife pulled me out of plenty of shows because we only had one car and we had to drive home and she wasn't staying. So, but for all the years I was at the Star Ledger in Newark, New Jersey, reviewing literally over 1,600 shows. I do keep statistics on how many shows I see. I never walked out of a show there. I wouldn't do that. Now, the question becomes, Joanne Kaufman, I mean, she's not the critic for the Wall Street Journal. No. Terry Teachout is. So I don't know if she really has the responsibility of staying. That said, I do not disagree at all with what Rick Miramontes wrote. Rick Miramontes, for those who don't know, is one of our leading press agents. And by the way, he's become one of the leading press agents in a very short period of time. He's worked in the business for a while, but some years ago he took over for with a gentleman named Tony Ariglio, retired, moved to Italy to enjoy La Dolce Vita. And Rick Miramontes bought the business, and that's why it's called O&M, Ariglio Miramontes, even though Ariglio is not certainly involved at all, certainly not on a day-to-day basis. So, but Rick has really got the clients. Michael, James, you must agree with me. You see, I mean, they have really proliferated, and you know, so they have really become major, major, major players on the Broadway scene. And he wrote a very articulate letter indicating that Joanne Kaufman is certainly welcome at any of his shows, but she'd better have her credit card ready. You know, the day of her getting comp is over. And, you know, I understand that point of view as well. But this is not as terrible as it would be if she were a critic on the beat. But it is surprising to see some of the shows she's walked out of, because you really think she was going to start talking about, you know, like Ari, the musical of Exodus, or Into the Light, or the one with the lemons. You know, In My Life, is that what it was called? The one that was at the Music Box, the Joe Brooks Show. Yes. You know, you'd think she was talking about that, but she's mentioning some bona fide hits and some well-regarded shows. So one has to really wonder how much she really takes to theater in the first place. And that, I am sure she regrets writing this now. I am sure of it.
Well, yeah, I mean, I couldn't quite believe it when I read it. Now, after the brouhaha caused by her article, I believe she clarified, for those who didn't realize, that she is not a reviewer, which I didn't think she was, because that name is from but and I don't actually know exactly what her position is, but she's someone else at the Wall Street Journal who gets press comps. But just to write about it so blatantly and boastfully,
was odd. I agree with that.
But I will say, this is interesting. I couldn't help remembering that, and I have a very clear memory of this, that when he was, certainly when he was at New York Magazine, John Simon would frequently write about how he would leave at intermission.
Right.
And then
right.
he would review the shows anyway. Yeah. Now, he would always admit that he left. And I remember his favorite phrase, which I think he used many times, was, "I fled into the night after intermission," you know, just pointing up how much he hated something. But I wonder if anyone considered knocking him off the press list when he was doing that, or you know, maybe he just had too much power. And this was before the internet, really. And, you know, it was a whole different world. So but I did want to, I mean, that did strike me that he, a reviewer, would make a point of how often he left shows.
I had forgot that, Michael, but you're absolutely right. He certainly did fess up, or even boast, shall we say, that he did leave this one and that one. I don't think he came up all that often, but in fact, I'm sure there are some people who wished that he had left at intermission, because they probably made their first appearance in the second act, and who's going to listen to him, you know? So, but that's a very good rebuttal, Michael.
Well, I don't mean to overstate. Yeah, I don't mean to overstate the amount of times he did it, but it was several times.
Sure. I mean, certainly as many times at least as this lady claims she's walked out of things. So certainly. So, well, we'll see what happens to her. It's going to be very interesting. Will they fire her? Do they feel they have to? Are they going to say, oh, this will die down? Which everything does.
I mean, can't quite believe that she didn't think.
I know. Yeah,
that would happen.
You know, the other aspect of it is that who really? I mean, Terry Teachout is wonderful, but who really talks about the Wall Street Journal arts page? But well, everybody's talking about it right now this week.
But it's true. But Terry Teachout has a tremendous influence. He's because that's a very powerful paper. I mean, newspapers are going down the tube, but the Wall Street Journal is doing very well still. So I don't think we can minimize the power, the reach of the Wall Street Journal. But yes, of course, people are talking about it more than they have been. And if there it is true that any publicity, even negative publicity, is good, well, yeah, then they're all set. But we'll see if they stand behind her. You know, in a way, I understand the editor's point of view from the vantage point of, oh, this is something nobody writes about. You know, this is a different slant on theater, you know, and I can understand that point of view, too.
I think it actually would have been more interesting if a person who bought tickets to something wrote an article like that.
Yes.
And I some people seem to be lumping everyone together, which I don't agree with that. Some people actually said, I think you owe it as a gesture of respect to the actors and everyone involved to stay, even if you're not a reviewer and you're not comped and you bought a ticket. I don't know if I agree with that.
I don't agree with that.
No.
Yeah.
If you buy a ticket, you're entitled to do whatever you want to
do. Yeah.
Absolutely. If you want to.
And I mean, you know, there are certain situations if it's a 20 seat house, you know, and you're in the front row, I guess maybe you might be somewhat more loath to leave than if you were in a 1500 seat Broadway theater. Also, it depends if you know anyone involved. I mean, I think, you know, there are other compelling reasons to stay, even if you're not a reviewer. And I certainly don't think everyone should be lumped together. I think that's kind of silly.
Yeah,
In the early 80s, there was a musical called Five After Eight. And anyway, it had a big Mylar curtain, which was essentially a mirror. I was sitting in the front row, and suddenly I happened to notice myself in the mirror. And I couldn't believe the scowl on my face. And I thought, these poor actors, that they have to look at me. I had no idea that I was so hostile looking, you know, and it really, you know, straightened me out. I've been much more adorable looking since then. I have.
So a couple of years ago when the media was removed from the Tony voting, I was in some sort of meeting with Michael Riedel and a bunch of other journalists and reviewers, and Riedel suggested that that we all pay for our own tickets and don't take any comps any longer, and because, you know, Riedel can walk out of a show whenever he wants and things like that, and many of us feel sort of obligated to stay, although. Rick mentioned in his piece that nobody is obligated to stay. They're just obligated to have an open mind, and whatever they come out with is what they come out with, and they don't have to, you know, nobody's saying that because you get a free ticket, you have to write good things about these shows. But it was very funny because many, many people in the room were aghast that, you know, we could never afford to run our businesses by buying, you know, tens of thousands of dollars a year in theater tickets.
Yeah. But why did he – so Michael was suggesting it because he felt that people were biased?
Well, people are beholden to, you know, we could write whatever we want about – he felt that people are too afraid of producers.
Does he feel that reviews of shows in general have demonstrated that?
Yeah, that was one of his discussions. Yeah,
that's really amazing.
So, you know, I guess either he or the New York Post pays for his stuff. And so because certainly he's not getting comped into any O&M shows.
Well, yeah. I will say two other things, and that involves the fact that Man of La Mancha and 1776, when they were just starting out, they were noticing that a lot of people were walking out at intermission. And they said, you know, if we could only keep them here, we bet they'd love it. And so they cut out the intermissions in both those shows. Mm. And it seemed to make a difference. So that's kind of interesting in the light of what we're talking about. The other thing is, I have to admit that when I see a musical – I'm talking musicals now. If I see a musical and it has an acceptable first act, yeah, that's not bad. Yeah, it's okay. It is. It is. The second act's going to be murder. I never learned that either. I mean, it, you know, you know. So in essence, those people who walk out after seeing a what they consider to be a bad first act of at least a musical, boy, they would have really suffered if they saw the second. Because really, second acts are harder. That's why there's that famous expression in that wonderful Steve Susskind book, second act trouble. Mm-hmm. You know, I never hear anything about first act trouble.
It really is amazing, isn't it? I mean, that almost – can we think of any example that – I know.
Occasionally I try, and I can't say I come up with anything. I bet some of our listeners will, you know, but for the most part, I can't think of anything where, wow, the second act was better. Unless if I had seen Man of La Mancha and 1776 with intermissions, I guess I would say both of those were better, I guess.
Oh, yeah.
I guess. Because, boy, you know, I mean, as 1776 goes on, wow, you know, you really swear there's no such thing as the United States of America, and they're breaking the news to you in a musical because that's a nice way to do it. So, yeah, so anyway.
Talking about going on, we have gone on for nearly an hour and 30 minutes, so we should wrap it up here. Anything coming up for this week you guys want to mention?
What I do want to mention is that Debbie Schrager really had a wonderful time at the Jason Robert Brown.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
You know, and she really recommends it. So, and Debbie's got really good taste. So if you're interested in Jason Robert Brown, he certainly has a lineup of wonderful people. Lauren Kennedy, certainly Betsy Wolfe, a lot of great people who come and sing his songs. Don't miss it. That comes from Debbie, and I bet she's right.
And, yeah, no. We should specify a little more. Apparently, he's doing once a month. Is that right?
Yeah, that's what I was just going to say. It looks like it's going to be once a month at Subculture.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah. And so we'll have to keep our eyes on that and maybe have Jason drop in for a 5-minute phone call and tell us more about the things coming up. I mean, certainly, Jason is certainly very organized with his time. Because I don't know where he's finding time to do these concerts.
I also listened to the Honeymoon in Vegas album while driving back from Boston, and it really it's a very well-produced record. It really is quite nice, and so I think it's a lot of fun, and I think it's going to please a lot of people.
Is that officially released yet?
I guess so.
Oh, no, I thought maybe you did that.
I got it from somebody.
Joyce walk up to your door and hand it to you?
No, one of my Boston friends said, "Do you have Honeymoon in Vegas yet?" I said, "No." He said, "Here," you know. So, I mean, what can I tell you? I don't know.
Well, either way, I can't wait to hear it. I love that.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
I'm seeing the Elephant Man this week, and also I'm hoping to get a ticket to. Have any of you ever seen Christmas with the Crawfords?
No,
I never have. I know what you're talking about.
Yeah. Joey Arias, the fabulous drag performer, is doing bringing back Christmas with the Crawfords, in which he plays Joan, and it's you know, I'll never forget it. It was absolutely hilarious the two times I saw it. So I hope to get to see it again.
Well, you'll get in because all you have to do is demand Joanne Kaufman's ticket. You know, and
yeah.
Right this way, your table's waiting.
Michael, you go on Elephant Man. What day?
Thursday.
Thursday, I'll see you there.
Oh, great!
Okay. Reunion.
Three of us.
Right.
Okay.
Well, all right.
All three of us. All right, so I want to remind everybody that you could subscribe to these podcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com, and there's a subscribe link. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. Of course, you don't have to listen to us in iTunes. You can listen to us in Stitcher, which is an application for your iPhone, your BlackBerry, or Android device, and stream it to yourself. Or listen to us on Broadway World Radio. Broadway World plays us Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. Contact information for Peter, Michael, and me can be found at BroadwayRadio.com. As well as to links to some of the things we've talked about this evening. So on behalf of Michael Portantiere and Peter Felicia, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. Good night.
Bye.
Is it possible she heard every last unspoken word racing out of my heart? She never turned to me, but suddenly we had so. I never took her in my- everywhere. Oh, she slipped beneath my skin, just as if she'd always been right there. Has she been there all along? Was I too far gone to know? What a fool I must have been, for how could I pull her in?